There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
We have some really exciting news at Motherly and have been hard at work behind the scenes on a big project. We recently launched the Motherly Shop, curated must-haves for motherhood. And you can use code MOTHERLY10 to get 10% off any order. Our editors have worked really hard to bring together the best brands for every stage of motherhood, all in one easy-to-find place. From products that help you conceive, to beautiful rugs that are washable and kid-friendly, to Montessori toys that inspire your child's imagination. We also have pregnancy-safe clean beauty, maternity wear, matching family pajamas, and much more, including our brand new pregnancy book, The Motherly Guide to Becoming Mama. The Motherly Shop's offerings are the perfect gift for a baby shower or a mom friend or, well, you. It's the best products that make motherhood better and more beautiful. Go to shop.mother.ly to check it out and use code MOTHERLY10 for 10% off your order. Mama, you've got this. I came across a headline from CNN a few months ago that really stopped me mid-scroll, and I think it's important just to read this piece as I encountered it. And this is the headline: Black newborns were more likely to die when looked after by white doctors. And the piece goes on to explain that Black babies in the U.S. are more likely to survive childbirth if they are cared for by Black doctors, but three times more likely than white babies to die when looked after by white doctors. Thinking about the fragility, the vulnerability of these babies, and the way that this article really illuminated the injustice that is still going on for women, Black women, and their babies when their children are being born, it just touched me as a mother. And I knew that at Motherly, we had to do more to talk about this topic, to raise awareness, to bring in advocates and public health experts who are at this intersection of Black mothers, Black children, Black families, and their well-being. And as a mother, reading about how racism can even affect a child at this point of coming into the world, it just was such a wake-up call about how much more work that we all as mothers have to do and how we have to use that empathy as mothers, Black mothers and their allies, to just talk about this issue, to do as much work as we possibly can. For me, motherhood can be a catalyzer to change, and I hope you're as moved and committed to being the ally and activist that we all need to become by this conversation today. Hey, Mama. Welcome to the Motherly Podcast, where we have honest conversations about modern motherhood. I am Liz Tennedy, the co-founder of Motherly, and I am a mother of four myself. Today's interview is with Black Women Health Imperative's president and CEO, Linda Goler Blunt. Linda's career is dedicated to helping to achieve health equity for Black communities. And at the Black Women's Health Imperative, she works on an important mission to achieve health equity and reproductive justice for Black women. Linda talked to us about how her career trajectory led her to this work, helping to eliminate inequalities in health. And she explained why the health of Black women in America is at a crisis point. And so she shared what Black women and their allies can do to navigate this current health crisis and the ongoing Black maternal health crisis. She also shared why an increased focus on scientific data makes her hopeful for the future. I was incredibly moved by our conversation, and I hope you are too. Linda Goler-Blunt, welcome to the Motherly Podcast.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
So I always like to open by asking like a personal question about motherhood. You're the mother of two adult children. You are a grandmother. And I'm curious, if you look back, if you think of who you are today as a mother, is there something that you think makes your approach to motherhood or grandmotherhood unique?
I would like to say or think that when the kids were small, we did a couple of things. One was a no TV rule during the school week. As it turned out, they didn't seem to miss a lot of pop culture. I mean, they seemed to keep up with what was happening. And then the other is, you know, I think just the importance of conversation and talking to them, you know, in an age-appropriate way, but about what was happening in the real world, you know, from the time they went to school, which continues today, and putting an emphasis on understanding where they are in the world and how they impact the world and the world impacts them. And hopefully that will continue with my grandson. And I have a granddaughter on the way who's due in April. And I hope to just continue having those kinds of conversations. It's just really important, I think, for all of us to understand that life isn't just us and our families, but we do impact what happens on a much broader basis.
So I want to talk about your journey to public health in particular. I'm curious if there was a moment in your upbringing or early career that really shaped the trajectory and your interest in public health.
I think as a public health professional, I had an unusual journey to get to this point. Early on, I actually was an engineering major in undergrad and was focused on being a biomedical engineer. And I was going to do that kind of work to help folks. I wasn't thinking public health. And I, in undergrad, attended an HBCU, Clark Atlanta University, and Georgia Tech. They had a dual degree program, so I was taking classes on both campuses. And I had a really interesting experience because all of my engineering classes, obviously, were at Georgia Tech. But in the 80s, in undergrad, I experienced a significant amount of racism, not just from my fellow students, but from professors who, on a regular basis, sort of questioned why I was there. You know, why do you want to be an engineer? Why, you know, and I was, of course, among the very few Black students in any of my classes. And for a number of life reasons, I ended up leaving and finished school in Michigan, but then went to public health school because I thought I'm going to do health services research. I'm going to sort of continue this work. And after I finished, had the opportunity to actually leave the country. I went to CDC, like a lot of public health folks, because of my engineering background, doing geographic information systems, you know, helping us track HIV cases across the globe. My husband also worked for CDC. So we moved to Trinidad and Tobago, where he ran the Caribbean Epidemiology Center. And I think that's what did it for me, because I saw not only a different way of living, we were in what was then considered a developing country, but I got a sense of health. You know, the literacy rates in Trinidad and Tobago were 95-96%, much higher than in the US. People were much healthier, even though they didn't have as much money. And so when we came back to the US, I started looking at health a little differently and made a slight detour. I actually went to work for Coca-Cola for 7 years. But in that time, I learned the power of storytelling. You know, I needed to get back to health. You know, I also learned that we in public health have a product to sell, like Coke, but we do a lousy job of selling our product, which is health. Coke taught me the value of telling stories. And when I left Coke and then came to the American Cancer Society, I brought those skills with me. And it really sort of opened my eyes to disparities, to the differences that existed in health, but also how to reach people. And then when I came to the Black Women's Health Imperative, you know, it was really the same thing. Like, who is telling our story? Who is that credible narrator? Who shares the lived experiences of Black women when it comes to our health to help us understand that we have power, we have agency, and that with the right knowledge and tools and strategies, we can make the best decisions for our health to be as healthy as we want to be. And so what I think I bring to and brought to the Black Women's Health Imperative is understanding how to translate the science and research into those stories, into those images, into those messages that can resonate with Black women to give them what they need to be as healthy as they can.
So talk to me about the mission of the organization that you lead. What has been its trajectory and what are the core issues you focus on today?
We've got a storied history. Our founder, Billy Avery, actually got a MacArthur Genius Award for recognition of her work in base building, mobilization, grassroots organizing to get women to understand the importance of health and reproductive health in particular. She opened birthing centers to serve women who were not being well served in Georgia and Florida. And Billy recognized that we needed to take care of ourselves, of each other, of course, but really importantly, we needed to take care of ourselves. We needed to practice what she called self-care. So she founded the Black Women's Health Imperative in 1983. We kind of joke, we say she brought 2,000 of her closest friends to Spelman's campus. She thought it was going to be a couple hundred, 2,000 women showed up. You know, it was overwhelming, but it was to talk about self-care. And so for 39 years, we've been very much focused on what we need to take care of ourselves, how we take care of each other and our families. But over time, that grew into specific programs. So for example, we've invested over $20 million in chronic disease prevention programs in cities across the U.S. It evolved into policy and understanding how policy determines access. We work closely with the Congressional Black Caucus, with the White House Council on Black Women and Girls to make sure that they understand that there are health promoting policies and health limiting policies and that we're in the room when these conversations are happening. And then, as I said, you know, research. So we now have lots of research that is actually on our website, but that we use to inform our work and that we use to help women understand what they ought to do. And I would say the latest sort of addition to our work, which is not going to be surprising to you in any way, is technology. You know, we've spent this, you know, 39 years working with women in communities, funding organizations in communities, and we've reached a lot of people, but we can reach far more through technology. And so we just launched in the last 3 months our chronic disease prevention platform on an app. So now wherever women are, they can have access to the same information, to coaches, to the kinds of resources they need, even if they're in the grocery store and they're looking at a food label and kind of understanding what that means so that they can take this information with them wherever they are and have it in the palm of their hands. So I'm really excited about that. And just in the last 2 years, we've reached 3 million women with this information. And so they've let us know how important this is for them and how much they appreciate the different ways we're trying to reach them and the different ways of serving up this information.
I want to talk specifically now about the maternal and infant mortality crisis in the United States. Speaking of storytelling as part of what is critical in public health, I was listening to a speech you gave where you said the research has revealed that race isn't a risk factor. Racism is a risk factor. Those are your words. Gender isn't a risk factor. Sexism is. So when we're talking about maternal and infant mortality crisis for the Black community, what is your research showing?
You know, of course, that the U.S. is, I think, 50th in developing nations when it comes to maternal mortality and infant mortality. Maternal mortality rates are dropping in every well-resourced country except the United States. And when we look at the disparities in general at the national level, it's Black women die 3 to 4 times more than white women. In certain cities, it could be 7 to 12 times. New York City is particularly difficult. DC is particularly difficult. But as you said, we know it's not caused by biology or genetics. And it's not even caused by poverty. We tend to assume these disparities are occurring among low-income people. But when it comes to maternal mortality, Black, highly educated, high professional, high-earning women have worse maternal mortality rates than white women without an eighth-grade education. So we know it's not that. But we do know that it has everything to do with what we call the lived experience. We conducted a study to ask Black women to define health. And actually, the number one health issue that came up for them, which was then validated by the Black Women's Health Study and by our social media analysis, is stress. And we know stress actually makes a huge difference. I've talked about Arlene Geronimus, who coined the term weathering 30 years ago, where she found that Black women were literally aging faster than white women. Tanae Lewis, who is a researcher at Emory, found that chronic racism literally changes the DNA level and triggers our inflammatory response and changes our metabolic response. And so what we see in maternal mortality are a couple of things. Our bodies responding to chronic stress, and that contributing to preterm births and low birth weight babies. The Black Women's Health Study also has found a causal relationship between gender discrimination and low birth weight babies, but it's also the practice of care. Black women in distress, pre or postpartum, are much less likely to be listened to or believed by providers. We know that throughout the course of pregnancy, they're less likely to have more high-tech therapeutics recommended for them. And some researchers think that as much as 40% of Black maternal deaths may be simply due to the fact that providers weren't listening to them. And we've seen tragic examples of Shalon Irving, who was a maternal health researcher at CDC, who complained for 2 weeks after giving birth, collapsed and died. Kira Johnson, obviously dynamic young woman, professional, complained in the hospital after delivering her second son for hours. And by the time they got to her, it was too late. Serena Williams, if anybody knows her body, certainly Serena Williams, a world-class athlete, understands her body. And yet, what did she say? She had to get ugly before people would listen to her. So it just breaks my heart to think of all the women who aren't and haven't been listened to, who have died unnecessarily. So, this is a way, we call it unconscious bias, we call it provider bias. The fact is providers are conditioned. In medical school, still 30% of medical school students don't believe that Black women feel pain as much as white women. So we have to go way back. This is 400 years of oppression and of a perception of Black women, one, as being less than female, but in many respects, many in the medical profession still don't believe that Black women should have babies. We've seen this throughout history. And so they're not treated with the same value and respect. We talk about a term that was coined a long time ago, intersectionality, where Black women live at the intersection of racism, gender oppression, and economic disadvantage. And all of that sets up circumstances where you're almost lucky if you get good prenatal care. You're almost lucky. We've got to turn that around. It shouldn't be luck. It should be the norm.
What was your experience when you were giving birth? Did you experience any of these issues that you research and cover?
I didn't, but all of my providers were Black.
That's a really interesting point, because I was going to mention there was a new study, I'm sure you saw, about a month ago, that Black babies were more likely to survive when the providers during their births were Black.
That's right.
What is that telling us about community-led, community-centered care?
It's really, really clear when there's, we call it racial concordance between providers and patients. What it means is the providers are more likely to ask the important questions because they themselves understand what their patients may be going through, may be feeling, may be experiencing, because they probably experienced it themselves. Mm-hmm. So while medical care may take place according to a probabilistic model, and this is where all providers are trained, Black and white and other, when there's that racial, that cultural congruence, a provider will think to ask questions, think to do things differently because of that experience. And so for me, all of my providers were Black. And if I went to, I'm thinking about my first pregnancy, which was fine, but I had some issues and I asked my OB and she said, well, it's probably nothing, but let's do this. Had she been white, she might've just said, it's probably nothing. And so this happens all the time. And when it is something, then it's often too late to deal with it. But also my providers would know the kinds of things I'm facing in the world outside of their office at work. So they think it occurs to them to do things differently. And this is why we see maternal outcomes are much better and birth outcomes are much better because of that. And I don't know how you train that into people because it comes down to value. My providers and I share a similar experience. And so we value it. If I don't share your experience, I might not value it as much as you do. So certain things might not occur to me. But I think in medical school, in nursing school, we can teach students to sort of always think of their patients as their mother or their sister or their aunt and try to treat them accordingly. And there have been a couple of studies where that has shown to actually improve outcomes.
Wow.
Just by forgetting that it's, you know, Mrs. Jones, but thinking of this as, you know, your mother or your sister.
It's really powerful. You've also talked about a need to reclaim birth traditions or traditions and culture around the birth experience. And there is a particular context for that for Black women in the US and the history of midwifery. Can you talk about that? And can you also maybe set the vision for what a sort of evidence-based but tradition-centered or welcoming birth experience could look like for women?
We obviously have a long tradition of celebrating birth, like all cultures, but not viewing birth and pregnancy as a medical experience.
Mm-hmm.
In the African tradition and then African-American tradition, this is very much a family and community experience, this bringing new life into the world, where everyone shares a role in raising this baby, raising this child, and sending this child ultimately off into the world. And so midwives, doulas, have been really important in the tradition. Billy Avery was talking about this in the 70s and 80s, about using and working with doulas to not see women sort of episodically, but to be with them through the entire birth journey, pregnancy and birth journey. And we have plenty of evidence to show the causal association between positive pregnancy experiences and birth experiences and the presence of doulas and midwives.
Mm.
That has been established. What we need is a policy solution.
Interesting.
Because doulas and midwives, their services are not reimbursable by insurance companies in every state. And if we could do that, there are a couple of studies that show that if we had universal reimbursement for doula and midwife services, we could reduce the infant mortality rate by something like 20%, which is huge, and would reduce the maternal mortality rate. It's huge.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm right now really concerned. I'm hopeful that this new administration will see that and will make some progress there. I'm hopeful that Medicaid coverage, for example, will be expanded to 1 year postpartum instead of 6 weeks. I don't know about you, Liz, but at 6 weeks, I wasn't ready to kind of get back to work. And, you know, I was very much still recovering,
mm-hmm.
you know, even though my birth was fine, I wasn't ready. So, you know, most people aren't. And so we really need to cover them longer. And we need to look at the pipeline, OBs, nurses, physicians in general. We need more people of color in the pipeline. And when you kind of think about it, you know, you're talking about evidence-based. In 20 years, this country will, the average adult will not be white. So 20 years isn't a long time, but imagine where we'll be 20 years from now if we haven't changed
mm-hmm.
the provider pipeline, if we haven't changed the researcher pipeline, if we're still doing things the way we are today. My concern is we may see birth outcomes worsen because of this. I mean, we don't know. And right now with the experience of the last year of COVID-19, I'm really worried that we're going to see more adverse birth outcomes because of stress. A year ago, Black women were not essential. Now we're essential. And that means we're going to those jobs because we can't work from home. So I am concerned that we may actually see maternal outcomes worsen.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
You brought up, of course, the stress of COVID and all of us living in a pandemic. The acute essentialness of Black women and their likelihood to be employed as frontline or essential workers. I'm curious how you coach everyday women who are aware of these statistics and the research and the bias at play in their birth experience, in their health experience. As you mentioned, there is already a 24/7 experience of stress that is measured by the cortisol levels in Black women's bodies. So knowing that they are at risk, I can only imagine how scary it is to be pregnant and a Black woman. How do you coach them? What kind of support would you recommend for the average listener who is like, yeah, I'm aware of the problem and I'm terrified and now I have another challenge to deal with? What is your advice there?
So one of the things that we, especially now, I mean, we actually just released a pandemic guide. So people can go to our website and download this pandemic guide for lots of resources and information. But the thing that's important now, even though we're in this time of physical distancing, is to maintain connection. What we're seeing and hearing is, I'm lonely. I'm alone. I can't be with the people I normally would be with, my, you know, kind of my tribe who might help me through this. And as you know, being pregnant is scary enough as it is. I mean, you know, pregnant people worry about everything.
Yep.
But now in the midst of all of this, there's this other really big thing to worry about. And we know that when pregnant people get COVID-19, they're more likely to have more severe disease, which is scary. But then you kind of add on top of that, maybe they've lost jobs or, you know, lost income. People are having to move together because people have lost homes. And so all of that raises risk and stress. And so one of the things we're trying to get women to do is to maintain connection, even if it's through a screen. Check on each other. I was saying this just the other day. See them. Don't just call them. See them on the screen. And if, you know, your sister, your mother, your aunt, your girlfriend's not looking good, if she, you know, she may say, I'm fine when you ask her. But if you look at her and say, you know what, you don't really look like you're fine, have a conversation. Try to find out, you know, what's happening. Do more than just, oh, okay. But also, you know, we're saying, please, if you can, get help. There's lots of online therapy because this is really a critical time. I mean, right now we know intimate partner violence rates have increased dramatically. Psychologists are concerned not just about depression and anxiety, but PTSD. Hospital emergency rooms are seeing increased rates of heart attacks, strokes, and among pregnant people as well. And of course, people are afraid to go to the hospital. And so there's that dynamic as well. And the other thing, you know, that you touched on is domestic violence rates are up, but we don't even know to what extent, because most children aren't going to school every day where teachers see that and then can intervene to help. And there are the women, and we've had many, many reports, who it's almost like a cruel twist of fate. You know, last February, March, we're planning to leave abusive relationships or relationships that just weren't working. But then when COVID happened, they couldn't. So they feel trapped. So we're saying find those people, stay connected, have people who might be able to just talk you through, you know, if you're having a particularly bad day, or check on your friends. And, you know that things are going to progress. You're going to have a baby and hopefully have a healthy baby. But the other thing is, and as hard as it is, because, you know, in our community, we don't like to actually admit mental illness. And frankly, in the Black community, mental illness is viewed as a weakness. There's a lot of stigma around mental illness. But we tell Black women, if your physician is not of the same race, ethnicity, cultural background, tell them, here's what I'm feeling. Here's what life is like. You know, hopefully they'll understand. I mean, physicians, nurses are trained to be compassionate, and you might actually get some more help. You might actually get some more suggestions. The important thing is don't keep it to yourself.
And such a good reminder to all of us listening. You know, we can't physically get together, but we can reach out. It's just a good reminder of like, who are those 5-10 people that you're just, you can check on. You can make sure they're doing okay, or let them know that you're thinking about them. I'm curious, when you were going through the experience, I know you became a grandmother a few years ago. Did watching your son become a father and welcoming a new generation into the world, did it shift your understanding of any of these issues that you work on professionally, or bring you a new kind of empathy? I know people sometimes say, like, There's a new kind of love when you're a grandparent. It's almost like a pure love. I know that's how my dad has expressed it. It's like purer than the parent because you don't have the responsibility. You just have the love. How did becoming a grandmother, how did it change you at all?
I think what it did was, one, it made this work even more important. My grandson is biracial, so he could face a different dynamic than his father. Mm-hmm. So as I kind of looked at him as a, I'm thinking about when I first held him, this, you know, beautiful baby, and I'm thinking about what his life is going to be like. He's born into relative privilege. I mean, his parents are working, they're educated, and I think financially they'll be fine. But I wondered about the kind of world he's going to enter into and how he'll be received. Because I think while he's biracial, when people see him, they're going to think he's a Black kid. I had a much, I think, greater sense of urgency. Like, we really need to get this done because I would like him to be able to just live his life and know that he'll be valued and judged, as Martin Luther King said, by the content of his character and not the color of his skin, and that his world and his friends would reflect that. But then, you know, sort of the realist in me worried about his parents. So when they're out and they're pushing this brown kid in a stroller, what are people going to say to them? How's my daughter-in-law going to handle this? Is this going to be more stressful for them? So it made me really want to protect them. It made me want to build this kind of cocoon around them, which I know I can't do. But I was also, you know, I'm hopeful. I mean, I as tough as things are, and, you know, last year, apparently the people in the United States discovered a couple of things. We discovered health disparities exist. We discovered racism exists. We discovered that they were related. I'm hopeful that as tragic as COVID-19 has been, but as tragic as racially motivated police brutality has been, and it's been that way for years, but we saw it more clearly last May. I'm hoping that maybe people's minds are at least open and receptive to what people have been talking about for years, and that my grandson, Dex, and all the kids his age who are kind of coming along, his sister, when she arrives, will have a very different kind of reception by the world, but different experience. Mm.
The Biden administration in particular is addressing the racial impact of policies, sort of a core component of what they say they're doing. What are you seeing, and especially as it relates to public health and addressing these inequities that mothers and families face?
Well, they're talking about it, which is huge, for one, as we haven't heard this conversation in quite a long time. But one of the things that I'm really happy about that they're doing is actually looking at data and actually calling for data and prioritizing data. And I don't just mean kind of research in the way we've talked about it, but actually talking about how important collecting data really is. One, it hasn't been done, but two, we can't make any effective policy decisions if we don't have data. If we really don't know the percentage of Black and brown people who are infected with COVID-19 or dying, or if we really don't know what maternal mortality rates are like in hospitals by race and ethnicity, because 2021 hospitals don't have maternal mortality review committees. If we don't have the data, then we don't know what to do. And that has worked in the past for people who don't want to know what to do, who don't want to do anything. It's great. We don't have the data. We can't do anything. But what the Biden administration and the Health Equity Task Force has said is, no, we have to do something, but we can't do anything unless we have the data. So collecting the data by race and ethnicity is critically important. And I'm excited because when it comes to maternal mortality, then we'll know what the true story is, because we really don't know what the true story is. And once we know, then we know what to do. And I can tell you, for example, from a policy perspective, imagine if hospital and provider reimbursement were related to maternal outcomes based on race and ethnicity. I guarantee you, you would see the Black and brown mortality rates drop dramatically. But right now, people can say, well, we really don't know. But when we have the data, then we will know. Mm-hmm. And then we can say, okay, hospital X, you're not going to be reimbursed. So we know how critical this is. I mean, obviously, I'm an epidemiologist, so I'm going to think about the role of data. But once we have it, then it can't be denied. Mm. Then the actions are clear. We know what we need to do from a policy perspective, and we know what to do from a practice perspective.
As a public health expert who's so focused currently on the experience that Black women face, What do you ask? What do you want to ask of allies? What can those of us who are not in the Black community do to support your work and just protect mothers especially?
The first and most important thing is just listen. Part of the challenge of this country is, despite the progress that we like to think that we've made, we are still highly segregated. So we don't even come into contact with each other. We're more segregated now, in fact, than we were in 1970. And just, you know, an aside is, we know from plenty of studies, if we could eliminate racial segregation, we would actually eliminate health disparities. That's how closely linked they are. So we work with a lot of different groups. You know, listen first. Listen without judgment. Listen without trying to fix or solve or explain. Just listen. Because what we're experiencing now is there's still a lot of people who don't believe what they're being told. Mm-hmm. They don't believe things are as bad as they are. They don't believe it. I've had plenty of people say to me, well, you know, if they would only fill in the blank, then they wouldn't have. Right. And, you know, one could just sort of assume just on at a sort of minimal logic level that we can't all be wrong. You know, it can't be that everybody is, you know, misguided. So listen and then ask, you know, how can I help? I've had plenty of conversations with very well-meaning white colleagues who, you know, halfway into my conversation, they're already jumping to solutions. It's like, well, you don't have the experience. You don't have the lived experience. You don't have the understanding to solve yet, but you can ask, you know, how can I help? Because community-based organizations will have ideas. And I come back to, you know, it's perhaps difficult to put into practice, but it is that issue of value. Pregnant women are very sensitive to everything that's happening around them. Pregnant people, they're bringing a new life into the world. So they're very conscious of what's happening. And I think, frankly, for maternal care, this provides a great opportunity to create these networks, because pregnant people, they're concerned about one thing. I want to bring a healthy baby into this world. And so it would sort of not be all that surprising to think that this could be the movement to kind of demonstrate and model how this happens. But we've got to get together. We've got to find opportunities where we can no longer be physically distanced, but to share these ideas, share these experiences, because these are common experiences. What happens in our bodies, these are common experiences. Whereas if you're just out there in the work world, you can live your life not having shared experiences. But people who are giving birth, we all have our stories to tell. And if white women are talking to their providers about how are you treating your mm-hmm. Black patients or your brown patients, even if they don't get an answer, what it's going to do is these providers are going to say, I actually hadn't really thought about it. So that unconscious bias falls away the next time they see that pregnant Black or brown patient. They'll remember that. Mm-hmm. Right. And maybe remember to ask a question.
I love that idea of this universal experience of, not universal for everyone, but to mothers, you know, pregnancy and nurturing new life as being the sort of center of empathy for these conversations that really need to happen. There is obviously so much work to be done, and the movement that you've been a part of has many things that are critical when it comes to Black women's health. I'm curious, are there signs that you see that make you hopeful about the future? And if so, what are they?
Well, I have to be hopeful, because otherwise it's tough to get out of bed. But I think there are reasons to be hopeful. I mean, looking at this administration, the kinds of things they're talking about in my world in public health and research, now we're really seriously talking about needing to be more inclusive in clinical trials. These vaccine trials had 10% Black people in them and 9% Hispanics. That's great, because NIH says you have to have diversity in your clinical trials, but NIH doesn't enforce that. So it became important, and it became important because I think Pfizer, BioNTech, Moderna knew what the response would be if they didn't do this. We've been talking about this for years, and so they knew. So I think there's a lot of what we're seeing now, and the reason to be hopeful is people are finally understanding what has been talked about for so long, that it does matter. And that they have a role in addressing these disparity issues to actually get to equity. And I think people are realizing that equity is not a zero sum. So much of this conversation is, well, if they get this, then I'll have less. And I think people are beginning to realize that that is not the case. And honestly, as problematic as we have seen social media be, it is a really valuable tool because it also provides instant feedback.
I love that.
And when things aren't happening the way they should, when disparities and inequities are happening, it can be made known immediately. We have tools now at our disposal and a public willing to listen. And so hopefully not go through this again. And I would like to think in 10 years, when you're doing your podcast, it'll be a very different conversation.
I hope so too. Linda Goler-Blunt, thank you so much for this enlightening and beautiful conversation and joining us on the Motherly Podcast.
Thank you for having me, Liz. I've enjoyed it.
Do you know what an ally is?
Yeah.
What is it?
Someone who you tend to help with the allies. They don't have to help you in return. You can just be doing something nice for them. But I think the definition of an ally is like a friend or someone who's like on your team for a game.
Is there anyone that you think you're an ally to, like a friend or someone who you're on the same side as? Maybe not just a person, but a cause that you really believe in and put your money behind?
WWF.
What's that?
It's the World Wildlife Fund. It's when you put in some money so that you can make a donation. You can choose whichever animal you want, and then you can choose that animal, how much money you want to put into the animal, and some of the money that you pay to it actually gets used to help that animal stay alive.
Who are the people that you think are in our world right now who most need allies?
Probably people who are like really old, but they're also really poor, so they can't afford to be signed up for a COVID vaccine. And then because of that, then they're probably really suffering from that.
Well, that's it for our show this week. Linda, thank you so much for joining us. And thank you for listening to our podcast. For more information on the Black Women's Health Imperative and their resources, you can visit bwhi.org and check out the notes on this podcast episode. We have a few more incredible trailblazing women coming on the podcast in the next few weeks, so I hope you'll tune in. And as always, we would love it if you spread the word about the Motherly Podcast. I know I say it every week, but it really helps if you leave a review. It takes 30 seconds. You can do it right now. I read every single one, and it really helps other mamas discover our show. The Motherly Podcast is produced by Jennifer Bassett with audio engineering from Seaplane Armada. Our music is from the Blue Dot Sessions. I am your host, Liz Tennedy. Thank you so much for listening.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.